Welcome to the 13th episode of the Ikiri Podcast Season 2. In this episode, we have with us Venetia Lamana, a fair fashion campaigner who through her social media platforms challenges fashion brands that are costing the earth and calls out retailers on their unethical practices. She regularly co-organizes actions against big fashion and is a co-founder of Remember Who Made Them, seeking to uplift the voices and demands of garment workers. In this episode, we speak with her about her journey as a sustainable living advocate and fair fashion campaigner, the personal experiences that inspired her to venture on this path, and her changing relationship with fashion over the years. We also speak with her about the importance of learning to take collective action against multinational corporations, about educating ourselves about the industry, her thoughts on the second-hand fashion market, greenwashing in big and small brands, and much more. We learn so much from this conversation, and we hope you enjoy tuning in. Thank you so much, Venetia, for joining us and agreeing to have this conversation with me today. I am so excited to hear your thoughts on so many different things. We really like the humor that you bring in to the advocacy and voice that you have, and I'm so excited to hear what you have to say. To begin with, my first question to you is if you can tell us a little bit, as a fair fashion campaigner, can you tell us a little bit about your personal journey and a little bit more about yourself and what inspired you to take this path?
Of course, absolutely. Firstly, thank you very much for having me. So I guess my relationship with clothes growing up was actually pretty sustainable. I grew up wearing hand-me-downs from my older sisters. I rarely went shopping because I grew up in the 90s, right? So if we bought any clothes, it was probably once or twice a year, a little trip to the Gap. And other than that, you know, I was not all that interested in clothes. It wasn't a priority for me. And then I think that changed, of course, as I became a teenager and I became more self-conscious and of course, wanting to give the illusion of cool, quote unquote. But things really shifted as fast fashion became more prevalent in the UK. So I would say towards my end of my teens, early 20s, I started spending a lot of time on websites like ASOS, and I started buying more and more fast fashion from brands like Zara and H&M and Topshop in the UK, ones we're all, I think, probably quite familiar with. Or some of your listeners are familiar with, perhaps. And I also at the time started working in television, initially as a producer and then as a presenter. And as a presenter, I felt like I couldn't be seen in the same outfit twice. So I started asking a lot of different fashion PRs if they could loan me clothes or gift me clothes for the shows that I was doing. And then with the money that I did have spare, I would be going to buy more clothes from places like Zara. And I definitely felt like it wasn't filling me, like it didn't feel good. This constant newness was not as shiny as I think it was being made to look by fashion influencers on social media. And through various things like getting into meditation, doing some, I guess, self-work, doing more kind of healing, I started to unlearn my consumption, especially with probably food and plastic and that kind of thing. But then it was actually on YouTube. I was, I think I was vlogging. I did a vlog about something or other on YouTube. And someone said, it's great that you're eating vegetables, but you're wearing fast fashion. And that doesn't really align with the way I see you and the way you seem to be quite an ethical person. They kind of called me in as opposed to call me out. And that was the real shift. So from there, I went away, did some research, watched documentaries, read books, read articles. And it was the start of what has proved to be the greatest unlearning of my adult life and the most rewarding and joyful unlearning of my adult life. And that was about 5 or 6 years ago now. And yeah, today things have shifted quite a lot. My work in sustainable fashion is everything to me now. So it's been quite a journey.
So can you tell us a little bit about the work that you do currently?
Yes. First and foremost, I'm a digital content creator. I make content on platforms like Instagram and TikTok, and I also have a podcast called All the Small Things. And the majority of this content is about greenwashing, holding brands to account, garment maker rights, the joy of slow fashion, the joy of styling the clothes you already own more. And then in my podcast, I interview people about issues related to social and climate justice. And of course, there are interviews in there about fashion. And then I also do some broadcast work. So things like TV and radio, I do bits of that, which is obviously linked to the earlier part of my career. But I think, and then I also, alongside this, I'm doing more and more organizing and I guess what a lot of people would call activism, which a lot of which I don't share online, honestly. It's a lot of kind of offline work, but there's a real mishmash of the things that I do, which is exactly how I like it. It keeps me inspired and it keeps me waking up in the mornings thinking like, right, let's get to work. We've got lots to do.
Yeah. So zooming in a little bit into fashion and your relationship with fast fashion prior to this journey that began 5-6 years ago, I think has been very, very similar to a lot of our relationships with fast fashion. At least that's how my relationship was with fast fashion as well. Like, I was interested in fashion, and a lot of us who are interested in fashion generally end up consuming a lot of fast fashion until we reach that point where we start becoming aware and, you know, realize what is going on in the industry and behind the scenes. So can you tell us a little bit about your journey with fast fashion and kind of detaching yourself from it as a consumer?
It was definitely a slow process, and a process that I think I will be continually on, just because of how fast fashion is rammed down our throats, especially as women, and especially if we use social media. So initially, I decided that I was going to really get to know the clothes that I already had, which was a really confronting process. If anyone else has overconsumed fashion and clothing, it can be incredibly confronting to do what I did, which was I laid out every single item of clothing that I had in a pile on the floor and went through every single one and could not believe actually the amount I had accumulated with and the pace I had accumulated it with. And that for me, that was a really important initial step. And it's actually something that I try and do probably about once a month, even now. I don't put all my clothes on the floor anymore, but I really try and go through my wardrobe every month to see what I have, to refamiliarize myself with my clothes, to work out the ones I want to wear more that I'm not wearing enough, to figure out new ways to style them. This is a kind of ongoing process. And it's a really helpful tool to buy less, because you realize potentially how much you have and how much you're not wearing enough of. In the UK alone, you know, the stats are pretty staggering in terms of the percentage of our clothes that we don't wear that just kind of remain in our wardrobes. And then I started a hashtag on Instagram, which was hashtag triple OTD instead of hashtag OOTD, which stood for old outfit of the day. And this was just a way to hold myself accountable and celebrate the clothes that I already own, and then also find a community and encourage that community to do the same, because the constant newness of outfits of the day on social media I found really overwhelming. So it was kind of giving myself and others hopefully permission to celebrate the clothes that you already own. And then if I needed something new, I would try and source it secondhand. And again, this is something that I do now. I'm a secondhand clothing advocate and will always try. And I also have straight size privilege. So, and I have access to secondhand shops and vintage shops like I used to when I lived in London, but I have access to a smartphone, which means I have access to incredible pre-loved clothing apps. So wherever possible, I prioritize pre-loved. And that was also an unlearning, because I think initially when I first changed my habits, I was doing a lot of charity shopping in London where I was living, and I definitely overconsumed clothing from charity shops because I was unlearning fast fashion, right? So I think I replaced fast fashion with charity shop and secondhand clothing. But I think I had to go through that to get to where I am today. And today I'm in a place where I really don't buy all that much. And if I do buy anything, I am considering it for a very, very long time. But it's really a process, and it's taken me a while to get to this point.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, it's so difficult when it's kind of rammed down our throats that, you know, you have to constantly have new products and new styles and all of that. And, you know, deep down inside, we do want to look different. We do want to have different things to wear to different parties because of social media and because what people have, I mean, conversations people have in our parties and things like that. It's all around, you know, this clothing that makes you want to have new products all the time. Is that something that you think is a problem for us in general, in terms of, I mean, of course, capitalism, and I mean, in terms of being consumers, like how can we, it's so difficult to not want those things. And it's so easy to disregard what is going on behind the scenes just so you can fill that cup of, you know, consuming something that you can, because you're not, we as consumers, we're not directly seeing what is happening behind the scenes with people in these factories and with the environment, of course, the environment, we're seeing a lot of it now, but I'm talking, you and me, we're in the industry and we kind of understand what's going on a lot more because we're well versed with it. But like end consumers, how are they supposed to kind of deal with it?
I think it's a really, really great question, and one that I'm not sure I have a clear answer on. I do not think that the onus of solving this crisis should be on your everyday person who, frankly, probably doesn't have the time to give this topic the thought that I have, the time that I have the privilege to give it. And for that, I would say that, you know, the onus here really has to be on our policymakers and our legislators to input the laws that we so desperately need to ensure that garment makers are earning a fair living wage, hopefully that they have equity in the brands that they're making clothes for, that we reduce the wealth gap between CEOs and garment makers. And also that there are caps on the amount of clothing that big fashion brands are allowed to produce. Mm-hmm. Now, if we achieve all those things, your everyday person doesn't need to, can buy clothing in a way that they don't need to think about it, because they could walk into a high street store or find something online and just rest assured that it was made by someone who's earning a fair living wage and that all of that adequate legislation was in place. However, at the moment, that's proving very difficult because of how the capitalist system works. It's not set up for equity. It's not set up for justice. So I think something that I am constantly trying to communicate to people is how their power is so much more than just how they buy. You know, I think this isn't me trying to diminish ethical consumption in any way, shape or form. I think there are so many incredible, small, independent, sustainable fashion businesses doing incredible work. But what I really want folks to realize is how their power is more than just how they buy. So in terms of slow fashion, for me, it's things like learning how to take collective action against multinational corporations. And I'm running some workshops with friends this summer where people can learn to do exactly that for free, which I'll give you information on if you want to share in the episode show notes. It's also about educating yourself, watching documentaries, hosting a documentary screening and spreading that message far and wide. Potentially, you could host a swap shop with your colleagues or your friends or your classmates. It's signing petitions. It is following garment maker unions and campaign groups on social media and learning how you can be in solidarity with their demands. All of these things don't involve buying. Mm-hmm. And I think when we collectively see the power we have when we're kind of when we're not so tied to capitalism, it can be really freeing. And I think it's so important. So there's definitely no clear cut answer, but that's the focus that I'm taking.
So with collective power, have you seen in the last, say, 5 years, and with your focus being there, have you seen some kind of maybe a few highlights of progress that we've made with that particular action that you've taken?
I think there are definite clear examples of how collective action in solidarity with garment makers has shifted the dial. Specifically, I'm thinking about the International Accord on Safety in Bangladesh and also Pakistan, and how through collective action, lots and lots of brands have been pressured into signing onto this accord. Very recently, after years of campaigning, Gap have just joined on to sign this, and currently we're building pressure on Levi's. Now, that takes everyone, that takes a lot of people amplifying pressure, but it is working. And we see time and time again that collective action, when it is done in a very focused way and in a way that is always uplifting the most marginalized, it truly does work. And I find that really, really encouraging. And speaking from a UK standpoint, there are greenwashing kind of watchdog government run or government funded services, which you can report cases of greenwashing to. And then those brands that are greenwashing will then be publicly outed, and they might have to go to court, or they might have to pay money for the greenwashing that they've participated in. So I think there is definitely exciting things happening. And we really need to hold on to those wins, because it can sometimes feel like we're up against a huge machine. But if anything, I have learned that collective action really, really does work. And we have to remember that.
Mm-hmm. One thing that really took me by surprise, and you've built this amazing community on social media, and you put out this really hard-hitting, powerful content that people are able to learn from and actually take actionable steps with. And I find that really, really empowering. One of the things that really caught my attention, apart from, of course, all the brands that we know listed that are greenwashing in some way or form, or, you know, doing illegal and unlawful and unjust things, one of the brands was Patagonia. I'd love to hear, I mean, I did see what you had posted, but I'd love for our audience as well to kind of hear from you what your thoughts were on Patagonia and it being such a surprise to me.
Yeah, it was a surprise to me also, because I too have been over the years fed this idea that Patagonia are one of the good guys. And I think they have done some great, important work over the years. And I think they've definitely led the way in a lot of ways. And they've really put some aspects of sustainability at the front and center. So they've done some great work. An investigation by a Dutch publication called Follow the Money, which is a highly respected publication in the Netherlands, found that Patagonia are sourcing their clothes in the same factories as some of the brands that we would deem as very unethical brands, like Boohoo and Nike. And to me, this wasn't all that surprising, just because of some of the campaign groups that I work with and other people who are really in the kind of garment maker right space. I've learned to understand that if it's a big multinational corporation, generally speaking, these brands are sourcing their clothes from the same factories, and what they are making is labels and packaging and brilliant marketing. A lot of people were very surprised by the news about Patagonia, very upset, very disheartened. I have to say that, again, when they announced that their CEO, Yvon Chouinard, was giving up his billionaire status in 2022 to set up a not-for-profit organization that was going to help climate crisis, it set off alarm bells, because how does a brand become a billion-dollar brand in the first place? It's through the exploitation of garment makers. If Patagonia had been paying their garment makers fair living wages, they would not have accumulated that much wealth. And honestly, I'm a bit tired of hearing billionaires say, "We never meant to earn this much money." I find that actually quite gross, to be honest. I think it's a choice. It's definitely a choice. So I think, and interestingly, you know, we haven't had all that much information on this nonprofit. There are no garment makers present on that board of advisories. There absolutely should be, but perhaps it's useful and interesting for you to know, and for your listeners to know. I've spent a long time calling out brands on social media, and within an hour of posting that video, someone from Patagonia messaged me and said, "We'd love to have a conversation with you." And I had a conversation with them, and they've been very receptive to what I've asked for, and not all that much progress has happened yet, but it's early days. So that was very encouraging. But yes, I think it's important for us to all realize that the big fashion system is rigged, and garment makers are not being prioritized by any big multinational corporation.
Yeah. With the secondhand fashion industry, we hear a lot about it kind of also not serving us too well at this point. There are a lot of people, like earlier when secondhand fashion had kind of was just cropping up, there was thrift stores and all of those kind of stores that you would get really special pieces that you can actually buy and preserve and keep, and the quality was of a certain standard. Now, I think this is in India for sure. I don't know in the UK how it is, but there are a lot of secondhand swapping that happens with fast fashion brands. So there is that consumption that's still happening. It's probably just kind of increased the rate of consumption. So you're consuming and also kind of consuming more in the secondhand fashion market. I don't know if this makes any sense, but what are your thoughts on the secondhand fashion market and where we're headed with it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think there's a lot of online discourse and a lot of negativity pushed on secondhand thrifting creators online, which I think is a real misdirection of outrage. The reason why the secondhand economy is in such a mess and such a state is because big fashion brands are producing too much. Mm-hmm. We're producing 150 billion items of clothing every single year. And currently, if we weren't to produce any more clothes, we'd have enough clothing to clothe, you know, if I have children, my children, their children, their children, their children, their children, and their children. Like, we're at capacity. We don't need any more clothes. But with any kind of discourse around secondhand clothing, I think the onus needs to be on big fashion to produce less. And then we just need to look at communities who have always dressed in secondhand clothes for an insight into the possibilities when it comes to secondhand fashion, how creative we can be, how joyful secondhand clothing can be. And also, crucially, big fashion brands like H&M have put a lot of money into persuading us that they are part of the circular economy and that they are part of the recycling revolution. It's fundamentally not true. We know this because there's actually a really brilliant recent investigation done by a Swedish publication called Aftonbladet. That won't be how it's pronounced. I don't speak Swedish, but that's how it's pronounced phonetically with my English accent. And they put air tags on H&M clothes that were great quality, some with tags on, that were left in H&M bins in H&M stores in Sweden. And then none of these clothes remained in Sweden. Three of them ended up in the global south. Three were lost at sea. Just an absolute, absolutely nothing what H&M has implied that they're doing in terms of circularity. Personally speaking, when I think about circular fashion, I look to my friends at the Or Foundation, who are based in Accra in Ghana, and what I've learned from them and the work that the local community do in Kantamanto Market is just how much clothing this community is able to recycle and upcycle every single week. And it is it's towering over the amount that big fashion brands are currently recycling. So when we're looking at solutions for the waste crisis, we absolutely have to look at communities in the global south, like the community in Kantamanto Market. And I think it would do the secondhand economy, especially in the UK as well, a great deal of good if they looked to those communities for the solutions.
So let's talk about greenwashing a little bit. Firstly, can you just kind of briefly tell us what greenwashing is? And also the fact that it kind of exists from the really, really large brands to all the way down to the small brands, because we've seen it. We are a marketplace for independent labels in India, and we've seen a lot of brands claiming to be sustainable and ethical. We aren't 100% sustainable and ethical ourselves, and we have our own set of values that we evaluate our brands on and work with them to kind of help them achieve more sustainability through their years of existence. So, but then, and we have our own system of kind of evaluating these brands, but we see brands outright greenwashing. What is greenwashing, and how do we kind of work with that?
Greenwashing, put very simply, is when a brand or a corporation says that they are doing something that's quote unquote good for the environment, when in reality that's not the case at all. So it's kind of like an environmental lie. And we see this across all industries. Crucially, we see this in the oil and gas and fossil fuel industry, where greenwashing originated, of course. Where else would it originate but with the fossil fuel industry? But yeah, we've started to see a lot of it in the clothing industry since people have become more concerned with the climate, and since fashion brands have realized that sustainable fashion is trendy and is current and is of the moment. So some examples of this are H&M's Conscious line, Skims recycled nylon range. What other brands have we got? Zara's Life, something Choose Life range or something like that. Boohoo's Kourtney Kardashian as their sustainability ambassador. Pretty Little Things Marketplace. You basically name a mega massive corporation fashion brand, anything that they say that they're doing that is environmentally friendly is categorically untrue because they are overproducing and underpaying. And currently there's not really enough laws in place to prevent them from greenwashing at all. So it's something that we have to be really, really savvy about, and we have to make sure that we're paying a lot of attention to it, because it's actually incredibly harmful. You know, like a huge, no matter, you know, it doesn't matter, even if I have people in my life who I would say know a fair amount about sustainability, and they are these same people will say to me, oh, but this range by this brand is okay, right? And it's so hard to kind of seep through the murky waters of greenwashing. So yeah, it's not easy, but they also make it so hard because they've got so much money to put into their environmental campaigns. So it's something we have to be very savvy about.
Thank you for listening to the Ikivi podcast. If you are enjoying listening to our podcast, do consider supporting us by visiting www.ikivi.com. That is IKKIVI.com. We are a small sustainable business supporting contemporary Indian brands. Our platform is run by an all-women team handpicking the most beautiful, ethically made clothes and accessories from across the country, all in one place. Our podcast is self-funded and will always be free to listen to. You supporting our work would mean a lot to us. Thank you for being here, and let's get back to our episode. With H&M's Conscious line, I've had a lot of people say, but it's their Conscious line, and that's why I bought from it. Or, you know, something like that. Can you tell us a little bit about what they are communicating, but also what is going on behind the scenes, but what allows them to make those claims? Like, what are they banking on that makes them think that they are being conscious with that Conscious line?
I think you've hit on something really important there. I think as concerned citizens, we want to feel as though we are doing the right thing. We work hard for our money. We care about the planet. We care about the environment. We care about each other. We want to feel like our hard-earned cash is going to something that is good and beneficial. And that is why I will never, you know, look downward on anyone who has thought they're doing a good thing by supporting something like the H&M Conscious line. Of course they do. They're being told at every angle that it's a great thing to support. So this is definitely, you know, not on people who don't know any better and who haven't come across how corporations are lying to us before. The reason why they're able to get away with it, or the motivations that they have for doing it in the first place, are very much that they know that we care, and they know that they can profit on that care. And I think, honestly, internally, you know, I don't have all that much experience of working internally with, or any experience of working internally with these brands. It's not something that I do, but I think a lot of them have convinced themselves that they are doing good work and they are doing important work. And hey, if something's made from 20% recycled polyester, then that's great and that's better. I would argue that the people trying to recycle that 20% recycled polyester t-shirt that was made by someone who is facing gender-based violence in the workplace and can't afford to feed their children is, I would argue that that's not sustainable. And I would argue that the folks in Cantamanto Market trying to upcycle that t-shirt which was made by a brand who were overproducing by about 95%, I don't think it makes any difference to them if that t-shirt has got 20% recycled polyester in it or not. So I think there's a lot of internal corporation greenwashing happening as well. And I think that's probably where a lot of it's coming from. But I also hear stories, as I'm sure you do, of so many people who have worked within the fashion industry and worked for very big brands and have had to leave because they simply cannot believe what they're seeing. They can't believe how much greenwashing they're seeing, and they can't believe how unethical the corporations that they're working for are. So, yeah.
Which is what surprises me. Like, especially now in today's world, we have so much information. We have so many people trying to create more and more awareness. How do these corporations actually continue on what they're doing, you know, with just thinking that they're doing well for people, like knowingly harming the planet and knowingly being unfair to people in not one-on-one, but in like large numbers? How do these people wake up the next morning? Money.
I wish I had the answer. I mean, from the top executive perspective, from the CEO perspective, and the top execs, I'm sure that's it. It's money. You know, they're getting a great paycheck. They're the people really benefiting from this exploitation. But yeah, I don't know. I wish I had more psychological insight into these people, because I personally wouldn't be able to justify it. And I would love to peer behind their minds and have a look at their psyches, because I don't understand it either.
Yeah. So I recently saw that you did, there was this, if I may call it, an organized protest of sorts in April for the Rana Plaza, to mark the Rana Plaza fire. What was that like, going into these stores, and what was the intention behind it, and what came out of it, and how was it received by the stores?
With any protest or demonstration, I think, with all the organizing that I do, everything is a learning curve, and there's always things that go well, and there's occasionally things that go less well. It's all a learning and unlearning. The Rana Plaza commemoration demonstration that we did was on the 10th anniversary of the collapse of Rana Plaza, and the main motivation behind it was actually a walking tour. So we went down Oxford Street in London, which is London's main shopping high street. And the motivation was really to bring people together. Community is so important in sustainability, and coming together with like-minded people is of the utmost importance. You know, it's a great way to feel connected, to share joy, to, in this case, commemorate the lives that were lost. Coming together, especially in such a digital world that we live in, is really important. So the main motivation with that was, it was actually very, very peaceful. The majority of it was actually just people talking outside the stores of the brands that were involved in the collapse of Rana Plaza. We also put blue plaques, which I don't know if you know this, but in London you see lots of blue plaques on buildings where famous people lived, or, you know, they could be scientists or actors, or it's always quite exciting if you see a blue plaque. It's like, oh, who lived there? It's an interesting thing. And so we kind of switched that, and we put blue plaques on the buildings of the brands who had been involved in ultimately the killings of innocent people, to put it bluntly. But the majority of it was very, very peaceful. And then, because I mentioned earlier, Levi's have really not taken any accountability for some of the harmful atrocities that they've been a part of over the few years, as well as refusing to sign on to the International Accord on Safety, we decided to stage a short, quick action in one of their stores. And that involved, it was meant to be all of us walking inside the shop, but unfortunately the manager closed the shop before we could all get in. But it involved a few of us going into the store, talking about the brand and how they were harming their garment makers and refusing to sign on to this accord. It was very quick. I think we were probably finished within 90 seconds and then we left. And the reason for that is that we don't want to disturb everyday working people. You know, we completely respect and acknowledge that a lot of people work in retail out of necessity, and it's not the retail workers or store managers that we're going after. This is very much an exercise in holding the brand to account. Now, social media is, of course, a part of activism now. A lot of people are on their phones all the time, and it's how you raise awareness about specific issues. So we also ensured that we had proof of this, a video of this action for social media that we could share, because that again is how we amplify and put pressure on the brand. They don't want to see that their image is being ruined online, and they care so deeply about their public image. It's why they spend millions on it, you know, all of the time. So it will be disconcerting to them when they see a video that is shaming them ultimately, with hundreds of thousands of views, lots of likes, lots of engagement, and that kind of thing. So that's an important part of, it's not everything in organizing and activism at all, but it's a part of it now. But like I said, it was a very quick action because we didn't want to disturb, you know, we didn't want to disturb the store workers. Was it perfect? I don't think so, but I'm still pleased that we did it. And it's, like I said, like a big part of the unlearning and the kind of improving on specific actions and demonstrations and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. What do you think we as consumers, I know we've touched upon this a little bit across this conversation, but what do you think we can do as end consumers? And also, where do you see us headed as a fashion industry, and what is the ideal fashion industry look like to you?
Oh, okay. I love the latter part of the question. Well, as individuals, like I mentioned earlier, we can really kind of really, as individuals, I think it's really important for us to realize that our power is so much more than just how we buy. And I would love to encourage people listening to really understand that, you know, if perhaps they don't go shopping this month, instead, could they put that time into watching a documentary with their friends or reading a book about the fashion industry and sharing that information and potentially coming along to one of our workshops? You know, all of these little things that I mentioned earlier that aren't about buying. In terms of how I see the industry going forward, unfortunately, it feels as though things are only getting faster with brands like Shein and Temu and or Temu. I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's like a new Shein, which has come about very, very quickly. Even places like Amazon, you know, this is like extreme fast turnover fashion. And I also don't feel encouraged by a lot of the luxury brands. Just recently, Fashion Revolution released their 2023 Transparency Index, and some of the same brands who received 0 points last year in terms of their environmental ratings and transparency in terms of their supply chain also received 0 points this year. So brands like Max Mara and Tom Ford, luxury brands who have a very high price point, are simply refusing to take any meaningful action. And I don't find that encouraging. However, I do feel like the conversation of sustainable fashion has really progressed. I feel like a lot more people are aware of it. It's one of the things that is really being talked about in the environmental sector and space. And I think a lot of people are working to make legislation come through. There's an incredible, important campaign happening at the moment called Good Clothes, Fair Pay, which for anyone who has an EU passport, please do sign it. It would mean that garment makers are earning fair living wages. And there are also more and more small independent brands who are creating clothes out of dead stock fabrics and things like that, and really prioritizing the health and well-being of their workers, that I feel very encouraged by and find very joyful. And I find in particular the slow fashion community very warm, very welcoming, very thoughtful, very creative. I'm very happy, excited, and grateful to be a part of that community, and I learn a lot from it. And in terms of what the future could look like, I hope that garment makers will be at the front and center, and we will learn to respect and value their labor and their craft. I hope that our high streets will be filled with small, independent, ethical brands instead of big multinational corporations. I would love to see garment makers have equity in the brands that they're making clothes for. I would love for the big fashion multinational corporations to just disappear and dissolve. And I would love for there to be caps on the amount of clothing that's being produced, so that we're not harming folks in the global south who had no part in this overconsumption in the first place. And I would just really love if more people, especially young women who are kind of prayed at and advertised to participate in this overconsumption, to know that their value is in their friendships and their relationships and their joy and their community and their heart and their goodness and their soul, as opposed to the clothes that they buy.
I love that. I love this beautiful picture that you've painted for us, and I hope we head there sooner than later.
Same.
So my last question to you is about what you have coming up in the next few months or in the next few years. Do you have any projects that you would like to share with us, or anything we should keep an eye out on?
That's very kind. Thank you for extending the invitation to me to self-promote. I'm very grateful. To be honest, I am not a real long-term planner. I am very keen to get the message about sustainable fashion out to as many people as possible. So hopefully that will involve more broadcast, more TV, radio, film, documentary, things that are long-term projects that are hard to get off the ground. I would love to keep weaving in, like you mentioned, humour into the content that I put out, as well as education and calls to action. I would love to find ways of putting garment makers more at the front and centre of this work. And I would really love to do more of the organising work that I'm doing with some really incredible women that I have in my life who are allies, but also friends, and who make this work joyful and meaningful to me. So at the moment, it's just kind of more of the same. I'm really grateful that I get to do what I do, and it's really wonderful to feel like I'm a small part of pushing for change. And I would love to say to anyone listening that you too can be a part of that change. There's space for absolutely everyone. We need people of all different kinds of skill sets and backgrounds and ideas. So this is definitely an invitation to come and join the party.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the work that you do. Thank you so much for adding humor to this conversation. I think that's such a great way and creative way to reach people, but still having a lot of impact. And I really, appreciate that. If there is anything that you would like to share, we'd be happy to include it in the show notes. We will also link to your Instagram page in our show notes as well. But thank you so much for having this conversation. I'm looking forward to what you have coming up in terms of creating awareness, and looking forward to more insider stories.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me in amongst so many other brilliant voices and guests. And thank you for the work you do. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe to the Ikibi podcast, a space for discussion on living meaningful and fuller lives each day. The Ikibi podcast is a property edited and produced by the team at Ikibi.